was hatred. All opinions expressed are those of the speakers, not necessarily representing the views of Billy or a few, or the UC or AMC. Also, the Imaginary Crime Tour, the people interviewed here talking about the effort to stop Cop City in Atlanta, Georgia, are coming to Urbana. They will be here this Saturday, April 12th, at 3 p.m. at the Channing Murray Foundation at 1209 West Oregon Street in Urbana. Again, you can meet the people you are about to hear. They will be present on Saturday, April 12th at 3 p.m. at Channing Murray Foundation in Urbana.
Airing on Asheville FM Nashville, this is the Final Straw Radio. This week we're sharing an interview with Selena, who speaks about the Stop Cop City Imaginary Crimes Tour, and Jordan, a RICO defendant from the Stop Cop City 61 RICO case. The two speak about anti-repression, about where the case is at right now, and a wider view of resistance and support. The tour will be hitting over 60 cities and not just in the U.S., and you can find out more at linktr.ee/sccimaginarycrimestour. Then we share an audio recording from Franklin Lopez of Amplifier Media with Hamza M. Salah, a journalist in North Gaza, about the conditions there since Israel has broken its ceasefire, and as food, medical care, shelter, and other basic needs are all lacking while bombs are continuing to drop.
I'm Selena. I use they pronouns, and I don't have any affiliations.
I'm Jordan. I use they, them pronouns, and this isn't really an affiliation, but I am notably a RICO defendant.
Can you give a summarized rundown of the Defend the Forest / Stop Cop City movement in so-called Atlanta or Wilani?
Yeah, so the two names, Defend the Forest and Stop Cop City, both refer to the same kind of mass decentralized movement to prevent the building of a police training facility in Atlanta that became known as Cop City. And I do just want to clarify here, we use the word movement a lot, but really the terms Defend the Forest and Stop Cop City were calls made by people all over the world, obviously most in the U.S., but doesn't refer to any actual organization that anybody could belong to. And to give some context to Cop City itself, Cop City was proposed in the wake of the 2020 uprising following unrelenting police violence resulting in the murder of George Floyd, Rayshard Brooks, and many more. The state of Georgia has a relationship with the Israeli Defense Forces known as the GILI program, which works kind of like a foreign exchange program where they can help train one another and exchange tactics. Cop City is a facility that features a mock city designed to look like a Palestinian or working class American neighborhood and will serve as an important training base for police forces across the country and around the world. So when we talk about the Stop Cop City or Defend the Atlanta Forest movement, this really kicks off when some locals find out about the plans to build Cop City, which happens in the spring of 2021. And soon word spreads, and there's kind of regular information sessions in the area, cultural events in the public park, that in that public park is a part of the land that was going to be taken down to build Cop City. And so for about 3 years, a lot of people took many different approaches to try to stop Cop City. Again, all kind of decentralized, people reading anonymous communiques online. And in some of the list of things that took place to prevent Cop City, immediately a lot of lawsuits are filed to challenge the proposal in the courts. When construction equipment eventually does move into the forest, it gets regularly sabotaged. There are weeks of action that bring hundreds and at some point, like 1,000 people from across the country to the Atlanta Forest. There was a national pressure campaign, meaning focusing not on political targets, but rather the subcontractors that are funding Cop City, pressuring them to drop their contract. There's famously an occupation in the forest. A very popular referendum is not passed, actually through very explicit voter suppression, is not recognized. In addition to things in Atlanta, there's also sabotage kind of all over the country, people tagging things with Stop Cop City. There's a summit in Tucson at some point, and this just speaks to kind of like how this was an issue kind of taken up beyond the city of Atlanta. Notably, also their Wilani Defense Society chapters kind of all over the country working together in their own cities to stop their own Cop Cities and the Atlanta Cop City. And I'll just also note that at this point, Cop City in Atlanta is now fully constructed and currently in use. But we should know that the construction of Cop City was delayed for over 2 years. And while the number is not completely clear, it's estimated that the police spent about $20 million extra dollars just in delays and increased insurance premiums.
There's so many different overlaps that bring the local into the wider scope and cover so many different people's immediate and community's immediate interests as to why they would want this thing to not happen, that I think that like the movement against Cop City in Atlanta.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that this resonated so widely is how ununique the Atlanta Cop City is. I think oftentimes people who struggle against kind of the repressive forces in the world can kind of run ourselves ragged at just how big and how powerful the forces are that we are trying to fight against. And I think that the example of Stop Cop City in Atlanta was a moment of kind of a lot of people who didn't live in Atlanta, including people who did, but kind of the whole country and the whole world being like, okay, this is going on where I live too. If all of us kind of focused on one kind of intersection of all of these forces, like you said, militarizing police forces of both the US and Israel, and we should also expect other states' police forces to get a piece of this pie, the destruction of a forest that actually keeps Atlanta livable. I don't have the paperwork in front of me, but with the destruction of this forest, the water and both the air take years off of kind of how much longer people will be able to live in Atlanta. And then, of course, the gentrifying forces in a majority Black neighborhood. These are things that I think everyone anywhere can kind of relate to. And I have been really moved to see people kind of being like, oh, it's not an either or. When we kind of, not to be too cheesy, but when we kind of come together and focus on one thing kind of with an intention of having a real effect, we can not only kind of like gain power, get closer to a world that we actually want to live in, but also we're better positioned for what we're facing in our own neighborhoods if we don't happen to live in that neighborhood itself. You know, an example of this is what I think a lot of people are talking about now is the Cop City proposals that are, I think there's about one for each state. A lot of them have actually been either postponed or completely canceled because they have seen how costly and how politically disadvantageous it is to propose something like this. So even looking at different states' Cop City proposals, the example that was set in Atlanta has had a very real practical effect kind of on the threat of this happening elsewhere.
Could y'all explain a bit about the 61 RICO cases, the demand for a speedy trial, and where the legal process appears to be around the case at this moment?
Yeah, so I just need to say up front that I am not a lawyer. I've never been to law school. So in September of 2023, the RICO indictment drops, and RICO stands for Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. It's important to note that this is Georgia RICO law and not federal RICO law. I won't get too into that, but I do just want to clarify. And this groups 61 people together. Some of these 61 defendants have charges related to Stop Cop City. Some don't have any charges related to Stop Cop City, but have charges dating back from 2020. The majority of these defendants did not know each other before the indictment, and now they only know each other's names as co-defendants listed in the indictment. And we should see this case not as an exception, but a furtherance of the states pushing how far they can expand criminal law. RICO is a narrative-based prosecutorial tactic that was originally designed to prosecute mobs or financial gangs, with the key being racketeering. So this is based on association, a kind of classic example to kind of like demonstrate what association means in this context is if you imagine kind of a low-level mob employee catching a charge, then that has legal consequences for who is considered the mob boss, even if that mob boss technically did not do that crime. So it's really based on association, which is why I also just think it's so important to say at the top of this that these co-defendants, many of them, the vast majority, did not even know each other before they were indicted on RICO. And so part of the name of this tour, focusing on imaginary crimes, which I want to expand on a little bit later, this is one instance that we see is actually kind of the state's imagining some dynamics, some relationships, literally conspiracy that does not exist, and basing their whole case off of this. A bit more about RICO law. We see this be used as a racist weapon during the war on drugs. The presentation that this tour will go over goes into a little bit of the history of RICO and kind of sets precedent for the fact that this has been an expanding law. This case is one more kind of notch in the state's radical expansion of this. We are also familiar with RICO law being used during the Green Scare, and it has continued to criminalize political movements, even when there is no financial element or any kind of conspiratorial association. Again, so association, despite the fact that many defendants did not and do not know each other before getting charged with RICO, the indictment maintains that they share an association through, and this is where I encourage people to read the indictment because it is actually quite funny, but they share an association through anarchy, a term that the indictment seems to use a combination of Wikipedia and ChatGPT to define, and it covers having zines, participating in mutual aid, general anarchist ideology, which in the indictment, they date back to the 1800s. The way that one lawyer, a defense lawyer who is not affiliated with this case, but the way that one lawyer kind of made this a bit more understandable is thinking about if multiple cars driving on a highway are speeding, right? They're all technically breaking the law. If we think of all of those cars in conspiracy with one another by the fact that they are speeding, or, you know, if a football fan is wearing a t-shirt of their favorite team, but that team has had a sports riot, you know, at their last football game or what have you, charging that fan wearing the t-shirt with conspiracy, right? So that's just a little bit on RICO. It is kind of a daunting law. So I really appreciate it when lawyers kind of put it in more layman's terms. And so besides that, just other kind of updates on the trial itself has not begun. There have been pre-trial hearings where we saw over 250 motions filed by the defense. And just to give a little insight into that, one of these motions that I found just very heartwarming was one of the defense lawyers put forward a motion for a stop work order when they were still constructing Cop City. So there was a stop work order in order to preserve evidence. This was not successful, but I just find it very heartwarming how the defense is still focused on what we're focused on. Another thing that people might have heard about the pretrial hearings was that the Solidarity Fund in Atlanta, they had their money laundering charges dismissed, which is true, is a very, very good sign, especially because RICO is kind of based off of criminal money laundering at its core. So those charges have been dismissed, but the Solidarity Fund is still facing RICO charges. The other thing that people might be familiar with from the pretrial hearings is one defendant, Defendant King, is the only defendant who had been granted speedy trial, but there still has not been a speedy trial for King. The state has missed multiple deadlines on this. King and their lawyer were put under a gag order, meaning that they could not discuss the case. And the defense files a motion to dismiss the whole case based on the state's failure to carry out speedy trial. And so we should understand that this still has not happened today. And it's kind of in limbo. King, just like all the other defendants, are kind of in limbo to see what the courts will rule.
And, you know, I want to add that, like, filing speedy trial is a very brave and cool move. You know, King was a 19-year-old, and by filing speedy trial has put themselves in a situation to go first in this, like, very scary, unknown court process. You know, it seems like filing speedy trial is kind of like saying, like, I don't need time to prep a defense. This is all bullshit, and I want to show the world. It took a lot of very quick lawyer wrangling and coordinating work with good attorneys. And if they do ever do put together this trial, if the state ever does, which they are saying they plan to, I hope that a lot of people show up to support them.
Just a few more notes on where we are in trial. One kind of element that I think maybe doesn't get discussed enough when we kind of think of the state and the repressive apparatus as the all-seeing eye of Sauron or something is that there are many career law politicians who do not want to touch this case because it is too controversial. We saw this in 2023 when the DeKalb County District Attorney Sherry Boston announced that her office was withdrawing from the prosecution directly because this is too controversial. People do not want to touch it. Judge Adams, who was the initial judge presiding over this case, moved to a different court, family court, with the option to stay on as judge, but eventually decided to leave and pass this off to a different judge entirely. It is still unclear why. We will probably never know why. But now we are waiting for Judge Farmer, who is set to rule over this case. He has yet to announce anything. And when he takes over, it's kind of up for question what decisions that were made under Judge Adams, if these are going to stick or if he's kind of going to start from zero. It's unclear what this means for pretrial hearings, what this means for King's speedy trial. And also just, you know, it feels like a farce to refer to this as speedy trial because it has been anything but.
Yeah. And as a defendant, I want to share that the like where things are at, like holds a lot of uncertainty and it makes it really hard to do things like sign a lease or commit to long-term projects in my like job and life. At any point, I can be summoned to Atlanta and definitely Adams was like, you have to come in person for these hearings. Notably, they had a hearing the day before Thanksgiving and they made everybody who filed that motion show up in person. So at any point, I can just be summoned to Atlanta, and we just don't know when trial is going to happen. Different lawyers have different guesses, and all the lawyers sound so confident. But the only things that we know are that the trial has not yet happened and that the charges are not dropped. And so this means for my life that I need to be ready to head down there whenever it is that they summon me, and that I'm hoping a fair number of supporters are also ready to come down to do court support whenever that day may be.
What does a legalistic framework misunderstand about the way that power operates?
Yeah, I have three thoughts on this, if that's okay. Again, I am not a lawyer and I have not been to law school, but I think most people working within the legalistic realm of anti-repression work can tell you that lawyers are trained to focus on their client and their client's immediate conditions, which is good. We want good defense lawyers to keep our community members out of prison. But that there's another element that kind of lawyers are not always kind of geared to think about, which is in addition to keeping our...
Again, you can meet the people you just heard. They will be here in Urbana on Saturday, April 12th at 3 p.m. At the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon Street in Urbana. Saturday the 12th at 3 p.m.
Hey everybody, welcome, welcome, welcome to another edition of East to West. Thank you to my lovely assistant for helping me set up today. Today I just want to talk about a lamp and light and what does a lamp have to do with anything in the gospel. When we think of a lamp, we think of an object that lights the darkness. And so we're just going to talk about how we can become a lamp, how we're called to become a lamp. And when we get that light of God in us, what we're supposed to do with it and what we're not supposed to do with it. You know, many times, many times, you know, we forget all too often in this troubled world that we do have a light inside of us that's supposed to burn bright and that's supposed to burn out the darkness in our lives, in the world's lives, in people's lives. And so, yeah, so we're just going to talk about that today. We're going to talk a little Super Bowl. I'd like to talk about that. Even though I don't have a dog in the fight per se, I'm still excited to watch it. I'm still excited to just see this competition, where these two teams are struggling to gain ground, struggling to get to that end zone, to score just enough points to win and defeat the other team. But first of all, let's just get into it right now. So I'm going to read a parable from Luke chapter 8, and starts in verse 16. And it talks about the revealed light. This is what I like about this parable. It's not talking about a light. It's not talking about, you know, a dim light. It's not talking about a light that's supposed to be kept, you know, hidden or turned off. It's a revealed light. God is saying to us, it's time that we turn the light switch on in our souls and in our walks with Him and in our life, so that way people can see the light of God. You know, it says, no one, when he has lit a lamp, covers it with a vessel or puts it under a bed, but sets it on a lampstand that those who may enter may see the light. For nothing is sacred that will not be revealed, nor anything hidden that will not be known and come to light. Therefore, take heed all you, how you hear, for whoever has to him, more will be given, and whoever does not have, even though what he has seems will be taken from him. So this is a very, very, I feel like a very pivotal moment in our Christian life, in our Christian mindset, because it's just, God is very clearly calling us to be a light, to be a light to the world, to be a light to those who are struggling in their own darkness with whatever they're going through. It's time for us to set down our agendas and to set down our ideals and ideas and surrender those, that we may pick up this lampstand that God has given us to walk out into the darkness of someone's life and say, enter in, follow the light. You know, a few years ago, my wife and I went to Prince Edward Island in Canada. Beautiful, one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. If you can picture rolling hills, mountains, trees, I mean, it's just blue sky, beautiful. It was just absolutely beautiful. And we got to go to this cove, and it had probably one of the most photographed lighthouses in the world. You know, it's amazing. It's just beautiful. It's rustic. It's just awesome. I've never ever seen a lighthouse in person. I've never been to one, but just the magnitude of it, just walking up and seeing this thing, this building with this huge light on top, and knowing that for hundreds of years, sailors could sail their ships into this cove by that light. Even when it was foggy, they knew to look for the light, and they knew that light would guide them to safety. That light would guide them into this cove. And it was just amazing. I mean, it's just one of the most fond memories I've ever had. It was amazing. We got to go in, go up to the top, look around. And it's just crazy to think that this symbol, you know, of this lighthouse really, if we think about it, really represents that Christian light that God has put in us to just walk out and light out the world. It's just amazing. I love it. You know, other places it talks about how you don't, you know, when I was a child, you know, in school, Sunday school, we'd always sing that, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Sorry, I cannot sing very well, but you remember the song. And it's talking about, I'm not gonna put it under a bush, I'm not gonna put it under a rock, I'm gonna let it shine. And it's just amazing that at such an early age that song was implanted into me. Now, further on down the road, that light wasn't as bright as it should have been, you know, but it was still there, and it's still there with you, it's still there with all of us. There's a light inside of us, and that light can be come in the form of compassion, mercy, grace, forgiveness, trust, do-overs. I mean, I think one of the greatest things we can do for our broken relationships or for somebody that's wounded us is a do-over. It's amazing. It's a do-over. You know, let's try this again. Let's wipe the slate clean. Let's do this again. I mean, it's just amazing how when we do that, how that light just intensifies. I mean, it's like, you know, when you walk into a room and you turn the light on for the first few seconds, your eyes are kind of, you know, trying to adjust to this light. But boy, man, aren't we glad that we had the light in the darkness to see, you know, what we couldn't see before? I'm glad I have a light, because I tell you, I probably would be wearing a lot of mismatched socks to work. Because, you know, the light helps us to see what we need to see. It helps provide that light that we can use to guide our life, to help guide other people's life. You know, a few nights ago, you know, we did One Winter Night. Amazing. Amazing. I love that it's done in the dark. I love that it's done in the dark of night, because in the dark of night, you just see all these, it's like I see all these little lampstands, you know, by the boxes, in the volunteer room, in the registration area, you know, on the smiles. I see hundreds of lampshades out there. You know, it's just, for me, they're not just box dwellers. They're not just somebody who wants to spend the night in the cold and say, woohoo, I spent the night in a box. I think these are actual lampstands. And I think when we look at each other, we need to see each other as lampstands. And some of us may need a bulb change or a little oil added to the wick. But we're all lampstands. We're all capable of shining light in the darkness. You know, God has given us that. That's I believe one of the great mighty things that we are inherently born with is this light that can be used to light things and to cast out darkness and to cast out fear and to cast out, you know, just things that cause uncertainty and that cause, you know, it's just wonderful. I just love it. I love talking about the light. I love talking about helping people. And, you know, and I think when we can really wrap our mind around this concept that everybody has a lampstand inside them, everybody has this bulb inside of them that's either turned on or turned off. And with us having ours turned on and letting us let the light of God shine through our lives, I think it helps them to realize how easy it is to turn the switch on. You know, God's not asking us to build a house here. You know, He's not asking us to wire people. He's not asking us to wire our own selves. He's just asking us, turn your light on and don't hide it. You know, don't go in a dark room and turn your light on, because a light in a dark room is just a light in a dark room. But a light in the world, when you're out in the world and people see this light in you and they see this joy and they just see this compassion, oh my gosh, it just changes. It changes everything. It does. I've seen it. I know it. I'm not just saying this in hopes that it'll work. I know it works. I know it does. I've seen so many people just changed by the light of God, because the light that's in us is not our light. We can't boast about our light. Our light is God's light. Our job is to be the vessel, to be that lampstand for God. You know, he just loves it. You know, he talks about in Revelation, you know, he talks about the churches and the lampstands, you know, and how they are in danger of having their lampstand taken away from them because they have forgotten their first love, to love the Lord and to love their neighbors with all their heart, soul, and mind. You know, and so I don't want to see anybody's lampstand taken away. I don't. I want to see it burning bright. I want it to be burning so bright that darkness has no